Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 5 of What's It Like? My guest is John Loken, who is a musician and consultant and...
I'm a marketing executive.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I am a musician by, I guess by training, you know, that's what I studied in school initially. And I've been a piano player since I was, I guess, 6 years old or so, started taking lessons. But kind of hard to make a living making music, performing, composing. So I always had fairly good people skills and decided that marketing music in particular was the way that I should go.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get into marketing?
Well, so I was in... First I went to Berkeley studying engineering, civil engineering.
UC?
UC Berkeley, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was an incredibly competitive place to be. And I just didn't, you know, it was at a time where in order to do that, you had to take all kinds of, you know, sciences and engineering courses and computer programming courses. I just wasn't that, you know, quantitative, I guess, and switched into the music program at Berkeley. And then about halfway through my sophomore year, a friend of mine was up at the University of the Pacific in Stockton and said, you know, he was taking a course in, or he was majoring, I guess, in entertainment management. And they had a program there that was through their conservatory. And it was a degree in music, but it was with an emphasis on music management. So it's officially a Bachelor of Music, but there were all kinds of courses in marketing, business law, accounting, finance, all these things to kind of round it out a little bit. The idea was you would leave this program and you would be positioned to be in the music business, whether in music publishing, records, artist management, touring, what have you. And I just thought, this is perfect. You know, it combines my love of music and my interest in working with people. At the time, I was I had been a performer at this theme park up in Northern California when I was a senior in high school, and then kind of graduated into the management side. So I was managing all of the musicians and some of the outdoor performers and the characters at this theme park. And so I thought to myself, I have management aptitude. And so it was really just kind of a combination of being interested in managing people and being in business, and then my love of music. And I'd also been a lifelong consumer of music and concerts, so, you know, massive album collection and all kinds, you know, I just went to shows constantly when I was in high school. So I thought, if I'm not competitive enough to be on the stage or in the studio, at least I can be involved in the commercial side of the arts. So that's what I went off to do, and moved to LA as soon as I was done with school. Got a job with an independent record company.
What kind of music was your record company producing?
It was mostly world music. It was the father of a classmate of mine from Berkeley. He had been an executive at Elektra Records, a guy by the name of Keith Holzman. And he was funding this label, and we were running it out of the pool house at his house in Brentwood. And so for the first year or so, you know, I'd drive over there and call radio stations, prepare one sheets for retail, edit the liner notes for the CDs that we released. Basically, all the kind of different operations that go on inside a small record company. Got my feet wet, really loved it, and then moved to Warner Brothers Records. And that's kind of where the marketing thing started. I was, I'd interviewed there for a publicity job, an international publicity job. And they sent me to New York, and I did international press in New York for Warner Brothers. That was my first record company thing. And just really got the bug. You know, I loved the lifestyle and loved being around music and the people, whether it was, you know, the artists or the executives, very colorful bunch. very creative world. I really enjoyed it.
So are you still in that world?
Well, that world kind of ceased to exist around 1999. I climbed through the ranks, I guess, in international marketing and got to the point where I was at Motown Records running their international department, taking, you know, Boyz II Men and Queen Latifah and Diana Ross and Stevie Wonder and planning their album releases around the world outside the U.S. The company itself, this is in a transition period, sort of late 90s, when they were moving to New York, and I wanted to stay in Los Angeles. I just got married, just had our first kid, and so I kind of jumped off the major label bandwagon, so to speak, and started focusing on independent artists again and running small labels. You know, it was very successful doing that, but by around 2000, the recording side of the industry really peaked, and that was around the time of Napster and MP3.com, and the whole industry really kind of started to decline at that point. You know, even then I could tell that things were going sideways, and I thought I should probably go get my MBA and get some real skills, because I'll never forget it. I think it was around 98 or 99. I went in to this job interview with, it was a video game company, an early video game company. And the guy's looking at me and he says, "So, you know, you've been in the music business." I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "You've had a lot of success there." I said, "Yeah, you know, it's been great. I've learned a lot and done a lot of great things." And he kind of squints at me, sort of narrowing, you know, his eyes. And he says, "It's not really a business, is it?" I said, "What do you mean?" "Well, the music business. I mean, you guys kind of sit around and smoke a lot of pot, don't you?" I said, "Well, yeah, I guess that is a little bit of it, but, you know, it is a business. It is a multi-billion-dollar business." But at that time, you know, the worldwide recording revenues were in the $30 billion a year range. Actually, $33 billion, I think, something like that in 1999. Well, fast forward 10 years and worldwide recording revenue is somewhere around 13 to 14 billion. So, yeah, so the industry really just got completely destroyed. It was probably a long time coming. You know, we could probably spend a few hours talking about what was wrong with it and why what happened. But the long and the short of it is, people were not as interested in paying for music anymore. I think they'd been overcharged, let's say, for a long period of time, and there was a huge backlash. And I just decided, as much as I love music, I've got to find something else to do, because, you know, the other thing about music, and this is true of entertainment in general, whether it's a movie studio, television network, even things like ad agencies, you know, if you look around, you see that in these super creative fields, there are not a lot of people who are over 50. And, you know, you're either at that stage at the very, you know, highest echelons of a company, executive vice president, president, COO, et cetera, or you don't work there. This is not, you know, manufacturing. This is not accounting. This is not a lot of different fields. You know, there's quite a few people, mid-career people at that age. You know, a lot of web businesses, you know, they just tend to knock people out at a certain point. They can't keep up. They're not interested, whatever it might be. So I just decided, look, I've got to go get some skills and I've got to find something new to do. So I went back to business school and got my MBA at UCLA's Anderson School. It was an executive MBA program. And graduated in 2009 and decided that I was going to go into a web business, a pure play digital business. So I took a job about just over a year ago with a company called Gold Star. And Gold Star sells half price tickets for live entertainment. So we have theater, concerts, sports, and I'm in charge of acquisition marketing, which is finding people online who are interested in going out, but you know, they don't have enough information, so they want to find things to do in their city, or they're interested in going out, but they don't like the prices. So we use a few different levers to try to help people go out more. Half-price tickets, reviews, user tips, you know, insider information about where to park and what to wear and where to go for a drink afterwards and seating charts and all that kind of stuff.
So do you have apps for that kind of thing?
We don't have an app yet. We're at the moment just a plain old website, but we probably will within the next year or so. Something like 90% of our traffic is from you know, desktop computers. But at some point, we will probably be putting together either a mobile optimized version of the site or an app version.
So with live events, is that also age specific?
It so happens that our members, the people that are members of Gold Star, tend to be a little bit older. I think the median age is in the mid-30s, mid to late 30s. But that's true in general of the audience that goes out to live entertainment, whether it's concerts or sports. It is generally an older audience, particularly when you're talking about, you know, concerts in amphitheaters, concerts in theaters. At the club level, the audience is younger. So if you go into, you know, the House of Blues or the Viper Room or whatever, certainly you'll have a younger crowd. But generally, amphitheater audiences, sports audiences, I mean, a lot of sports audiences are families, but when they're not families, it tends to be, you know, late 30s kind of median age.
So is this a different kind of marketing than the when you were working with a music company, or is it basically the same?
Well, it's different. In music, whether it was recordings or I did have a stint where I was working for Live Nation for a while doing concert marketing, you're really in the demand generation business. You may say that you may think that you're in customer acquisition, but rarely are you directly selling to consumers. There's not a lot of direct-to-consumer or D2C business models in music or concerts. Generally, there are intermediaries that you're working with. That might be Target, Walmart, Best Buy, Ticketmaster. But invariably, there's at least one sort of distributor or seller in between the people that are, you know, putting on the concerts and the audience, or the people that are making the recordings and the audience.
Does that give you a two-prong approach then, where you have to not only deal with your retail staff or companies, but then you also have to advertise to the customers in order to get them to go to the retail place?
Yeah, that's exactly right. In the music business, and this has probably changed, I haven't been in a pure play, you know, record company for quite a while now. But it used to be essentially that you would have a lot of sort of demand generation activities, whether that's let's make a video for MTV or let's take a single out to radio stations. That's all promotion, you know, let's book our artist on Jay Leno. It's a lot of promotion and creating visibility and awareness that you've got a new record out. And then the second part of it is the relationships with distributors and retail. So at Best Buy, you know, what kind of end cap can we get? What sort of advertising program can we put into their Sunday circular that they put in the paper? And nowadays, I think that a lot of it has to do with what's the sort of pricing isn't as much of a deal on places like iTunes because there's kind of one price level for the most part, or one price structure, but a lot of it is about positioning. So whether it's Amazon or eMusic or iTunes, certainly, you know, how am I promoting my artist there? Am I giving exclusive content to iTunes so that they can put together a special, you know, promotional EP and that'll get me front page placement? And there are a ton of sites where they may not be, they don't sell directly on them, but they have links from them to online retailers that do sell music. So like in LA, there's a popular radio station called KCRW. And you can go online to their playlist and look at any song that they've been playing on the air or streaming online, and there's buttons to the Amazon MP3 store and iTunes, and you can buy it through those channels. So the link, I guess, between the demand generation and the actual transaction of buying music has gotten a lot shorter, you know, and it's a more direct route now.
And with your marketing currently, for your current employer, it is also you don't have the middleman of the retailer, but you still have to, don't you have to generate enthusiasm or whatever, however you would describe it in marketing terms?
Yeah, we're probably more of a distributor in this sense. What we do is we work with about 5,000 different producers, promoters, teams, leagues, arts organizations around the country. We're in about 20 U.S. cities. And they'll, you know, if you're the Dodgers or you're Wicked, the musical being performed at the Pantages, or you're the L.A. Philharmonic at the Hollywood Bowl, you do not typically sell through all of your tickets. I think in general, across sports and music, something like 30% of inventory goes unsold. So we kind of act as a distribution channel to take some of that 30% of unsold inventory. We sell it for half price, and we act as a consignment seller. So we take no risk in the inventory. If you're the Pantages and you've got Wicked, you give Gold Star several hundred tickets to sell on our site, and we pass the revenue straight through to you.
It's like plane tickets.
Yeah, it's as if we were a you know, seller plane tickets. It's so we just act really as the retailer. But you know, I suppose it's a little bit different because we do promotion, and we have things. You know, we have newsletters where we reach out to our subscribers and let them know about local events in their market. You know, here are the hottest shows, here's are the hottest sellers, things that people are buying. We see that you're interested in sports, so you might want to know that, you know, NASCAR is coming to town, or we create interest. We do create demand. We generate demand for the events, and then we sell the tickets to them.
But you're more interested in incremental marketing, to have them come and then have them come again and you sell them the next thing, whatever next step there is.
The ideal for us is to find buyers who are return and repeat, you know, buyers, to have that sort of ongoing relationship with members. And we really focus on that, you know, particularly me doing member acquisition for the business. When I'm out there trying to find new members, there's a great focus on quality and making sure that we're finding people that are actually engaged in the arts, not just sort of one-time buyers.
Yeah, so you need somebody who this is their area, their hobby, their interest.
That's right.
What's the best thing about your job?
What is the best thing about my job? You know, I really enjoy, I get a lot of satisfaction, enormous satisfaction actually, more than I thought was possible from the idea, and I think this is unique to web marketing. But where you can create a test for something, you can conduct an experiment, if you will, online, and you can immediately see results from it, or a lack of results, but it allows you to measure in very granular kind of detail the outcome. You know, again, in the music business, we would make a record, a CD, and we'd put it out, and your only measurement of its success was whether or not you sold through CDs at retail. And the information was kind of delayed, and you didn't know who those buyers were. You just would get a report once a week saying, oh, we sold, you know, X thousands of copies of this particular album. With online marketing, it's just instant gratification. You know, you can see immediately through what they call analytics, what people are looking at, what they're buying, how long they're spending on the site, how much they're spending. You get some insight into the demographics, you know, who they are, what sites they visit. So I love the sort of direct relationship between effort and outcome. it's very satisfying. You know, it's very organized. You know, for whatever reason, I think that it's almost like a reaction to the first, 20 years of my career where things were very kind of loosey-goosey, touchy-feely, everything was instinctual, and now everything is very process-oriented, and, it's kind of linear. We experiment with things, and then we see an immediate result from them.
We'll have more with John right after this reminder. It's just a reminder about the importance of health. CFIDS, C-F-I-D-S, stands for Chronic Fatigue and Immune Dysfunction Syndrome. It's a complex disorder that impacts many parts of the body. It's more than just being tired. It's having your life devastated. My daughter went to Nicaragua after her sophomore year in Harvard. She volunteered in an orphanage and came home with a flu-like condition, which turned into an autoimmune disorder. And she went from being very active to bedridden. She's been sick for 11 years, and there's no cure for her condition. But new research on retroviruses gives some hope, so please, go to cfids.org and click on donate. cfids.org. Thanks very much. So, John, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
How do I give myself a kick in the pants? Well, it depends on if you're talking about sort of short-term motivation or long-term motivation. I think in terms of kind of short-term motivation, bursts of energy, get up off the sofa, get out of bed, get to work early. For me personally, there's nothing quite as good as a double espresso and a 3-mile run. I find actually exercise is really a fantastic stimulant. Really kind of clears my head. I get a lot of thinking time. I do a lot of kind of creative stuff in my head while I'm running or cycling and sort of ideating and coming up with concepts and plans and strategies and so forth. In terms of long-term motivation, I think about that a lot. And I think about, I guess this is a function of my age and sort of getting older. You start to think about what's the end game? What is the outcome? Where's this all going? I think at the beginning of your career, you just kind of run full steam ahead. You're 22, 25, whatever, and you don't really think about the future too much. I mean, you imagine in the back of your head, someday I may have children and I'll get married and I'll have a house and, all those things that we're brought up to believe in. And when you get, maybe midway through the whole thing, which I guess is where I am, and it's particularly, again, it's maybe somewhat unique to my situation because I was in an industry which went sideways and kind of collapsed around me. But you start to think about, where's this all going? What is the point? When I was going through the process of auditing business schools, there was a great presentation, and one of the deans of one of the schools said, the average person has, I'm going to forget the exact stats, but it's something like 2.5 careers in their life and 15 different jobs or something like that. And that's very different. I grew up in an era when, your parents, typically your father, went off to work and had the same job for 30 years, worked for one company. My dad worked for IBM. And at the end of 25 years, he retired and he got the gold watch. That doesn't really exist very much anymore. It certainly doesn't exist in my industry. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a point anyway nowadays where I kind of think about, what is the next step? What's the next phase for me? Am I going to do something that is purely entrepreneurial and go out and start my own business? Am I going to stay in the business that I'm in and take a larger role? And I'm speaking about the specific company that I work for right now. Do I want to go back to a large corporation and try to climb, the ladder a little further, to get up to that kind of senior executive level? So I guess my long-term motivation nowadays is really thinking about, where do I want to be at 50? Where do I want to be at 60? And where do I want to be at 70? Because chances are none of us are really going to be able to retire before we're 70. And for me, anyway, that's 25 years from now. I've got to figure out what the heck I do when I grow up.
Well, I've decided not to.
That's as good an answer as any, right?
Yeah, exactly. When you were growing up, how did your parents impact your worldview?
I would say very kind of traditionally. You know, my father was kind of a company man. He worked for Big Blue, is what they called IBM. And it was certainly a company with a very specific culture and philosophy. They had a company song, and they had a magazine that the company published, and the way they would move their executives and their sales managers around the world from the different plants. So he had, I think, a very traditional sort of corporate view of what one does when one grows up. You know, you go work for a company and you climb the ladder and you buy a house. Very linear, very sort of progressive. You progress from one step upward to the next. It's sort of a ladder you climb. And the biggest surprise to me, I think, was getting out of school and getting into 10 years of being in business and finding out that, and again, this is a function of when this happened, when the era that I did this in, but life is not always about these upward steps. And so, you know, the other thing that my parents, I think, were really good at teaching me is how to be flexible, how to think on your feet, how not to get discouraged. You know, for my mother in particular, too, I was raised with just a huge passion for the arts. And whether that's books, painting, architecture, cooking, film, music, I mean, it was just a house with all kinds of sort of, arts and culture. We were just soaked in it, you know, from a really early age. When I was six or whatever, I would be the only kid in the symphony hall, right? They would take me to see great orchestras and operas and to the museum and then kind of interesting cultural things. Like, both my parents were from the Midwest and grew up there in the 40s and 50s, you know, sort of fairly conservative farm people. And yet, you know, we moved to California in the late 60s and every once in a while, we would go to this Baptist church in San Francisco, the Glide Memorial Church. It's a really odd thing for, farming white people from the Midwest to do. But it's just what they did. You know, they just really believed in kind of exploring things and not being afraid of things. And I guess that rubbed off on me.
Now that you have survived childhood, what constitutes family for you now?
Family for me now is really, you know, my wife and my two children. I've got a 15-year-old boy and a 12-year-old daughter.
How fun.
It is fun. In fact, it's a lot of fun. It's the most fun there is. You know, we love spending time around one another. We have a lot of laughs. We're very silly and very tender, you know, and very supportive. And we are also a very engaged in the arts and culture kind of family, you know. Both my kids are interested in music and performing and art and all those things. So, and they're both, you know, my parents were very focused, I think as a lot of parents are, on really, you know, academic performance. And so we, you know, that's a priority around the house, is the kids focus on grades, doing well in school. So it's great. That's certainly the high point in life, isn't it? You know, you start to realize that no matter what happens in the rest of the world, if I've got these three people with me, I'm going to be just fine.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Probably not to the core, but certainly, I'd say the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I left Live Nation in at the end of, beginning of 2007, and had just turned 40, and that was an opportunity to redefine myself. But that was not an easy thing to do, and it coincided with, you know, I think people are looking back now at the 2000s as a decade of a whole lot of stagnation.
Yes.
In a few different ways, in a few different areas, economic stagnation being the most prominent. But so here I am, you know, a guy who spent his whole career in music, and which is a dead industry, and, you know, at 40 with no useful skills. So I went back to business school, I started actually my own creative agency. It was a digital agency that used music as a means for brand clients to acquire and engage customers. So if you're Pepsi or you're Walmart, and you know, music is a very emotional pull for consumers, and it's a great way to position your brand as, you know, as anything you sort of want to position yourself as. So if you are interested in a more adult audience, you can use music of more sophisticated artists like, you know, Norah Jones or Paul Simon to communicate with those consumers. So I started that agency and was really kind of trying to figure out what the next move was. And I guess I'm now at the end of that process, but it's been extremely challenging. It's been a time where I have not made a lot of money, and it's been taxing on everybody. And but it's great. It's also a way, I think, for the family to pull together. You know, they saw what Dad was going through. And, I mean, this is very kind of, it's personal,
yes.
I guess. But I think it's good for children to see their parents challenged with things, to struggle with things, to not be daunted by challenges, to not be bullied by the sort of negativity or the things that come up.
It's nice to see the family as a team.
As a team. And I think it pulls you together as well. You know, it's not like, you know, Dad would come home with the sad look on his face, you know, the hangdog, oh, I got passed over by another job. You know, it wasn't, it wasn't a depression era tableau, but it was certainly, you know, just a challenging time. And it still is. And we are certainly not unique. In fact, we're very blessed. There's the way I kind of look at it is when I was in business school, the economy just completely imploded. And overnight, you know, all the clients that we had at the agency lost their funding and the money evaporated. And we had to let go of our sales staff and close down our office. My business partner and I had about $40,000 in receivables that were never going to be paid. So it ended very quickly. And over the next 6 months, this is from March of 2009 to September of 2009, roughly, I think it's 7 million people were unemployed, became unemployed. And the way I used to think about it is, my God, you know, I'm sitting on the bench here and I'm trying to get back in the game, and all of a sudden there's 7 million people sitting on the bench next to me. And so we're not alone. We're incredibly fortunate. I mean, I just, we're so blessed that we are living in a house that is, there's still some equity in it, and that kind of allows me to sleep a little bit at night. And then, you do realize that, again, it's not about the physical possessions. It's not about, you know, oh my God, I'm losing my beautiful house, or I have to sell my car, or I have to, you know, take a job, I have to take a pay cut or whatever. None of that matters. What really matters is the love you have, you know, with your family, whether it's your children, your parents, your friends, your brothers and sisters. That is really what's important. And the rest of it, frankly, is just kind of icing.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, giving your best advice, what would you say?
Funny you should ask that, Ken. I actually delivered the commencement address at UCLA when I was graduating from Anderson 2 years ago. I didn't so much give advice. I think I was more thinking somewhat rhetorically about the role of business, the role of private enterprise in the world. And I really challenge business leaders in general to take a more holistic approach to how they conduct themselves. I think that traditional management theory is really about the interests of the firm and, you know, creating value for shareholders. And that is certainly part of it, and that has a role. But I think there's another role, which is the concept of social return. And I think too often over the last 30 years, the financial return of businesses has come at the expense of social return. So, you know, the banks are an obvious example where they created enormous wealth for themselves at the expense of millions and millions of people. And when that went down, it sucked not only the industry, you know, the banking industry down, also the American taxpayer, but also people around the world because of the nature of global interdependency. And it's not just banking. It's really any industry. If it thinks only of its own interests, it almost always comes at the expense of someone else, of whether it's an environmental interest, a community interest, or even a customer interest. So I think the big challenge, and if I, you know, couch it as a piece of advice, but I think that businesses in general should take a more sort of multi-stakeholder approach to how they conduct themselves. Think about social return as much as financial return.
The last question is to help me get better at this process. I'm sure you have a good story that I haven't asked you about. What question should I have asked you for you to tell me it?
You know, I've probably blathered on quite a bit, but I'll tell you, I mean, just a little anecdote, I guess, or a little adjunct to the story of turning 40 and having to redefine oneself and having to write one's own second act. I was approaching 40, and I've been a cyclist. I've done a lot of bike rides for the last maybe decade or so. And a few years ago, I started running. And I decided right after I turned 40 that I was going to do my first triathlon. And the problem was I didn't know how to swim. And I'd had a traumatic incident as a child. I think it was 5 or 6. And I, you know, fell into the pool and couldn't swim and nearly drowned. And it was just, you know, so I'd always had sort of a fear of water, never learned how to swim. Well, in a triathlon, and the one I did, it was what they call a sprint distance, but it was still a half mile swim. So at the tender age of 40, I went to the local public pool and I sat in the shallow end. And I really had to learn from, you know, the basics up. I had to learn how to actually put my face in the water and exhale through my nose and turn my head to one side and breathe and inhale, put my face back in the water, exhale through my nose, face up on the other side, you know, the crawl, right? That's what they call that kind of swimming. But if you're going to swim a half mile, you've got to learn how to do it. You can't fake it. You can't dog paddle. You can't side stroke. You've got to learn how to, you know, you got to have a decent freeform sort of crawling swim. A crawling stroke. So here I was at 40 doing this kind of ridiculous thing. And as I'm sitting in the shallow end, you know, there's children all around me, you know, with their floaties and sort of having fun. I thought, this just must look ridiculous, you know? And it was really gratifying, Ken. It was like to be forced to have to learn how to do something so basic and elementary, I think really just sort of boils, you know, life and life's challenges down to their elements, you know, and you just realize anything can be learned, anything, just about anything can be achieved. You have to, you know, pride has absolutely no value, in my view anyway. There's no upside to sort of being proud or vain about certain, you know, certain things. And you just have to get in there and do it. And I worked so hard. You know, I'm a believer in diligence and maximum output. And lo and behold, you know, over the course of days and then weeks and then months and a lot of training, I learned how to swim. And I swam my first triathlon, and I've done a couple since. And, you know, it was important for me. I had to prove that to myself. So I guess, you know, if there's one parting piece of advice I could give, it's, you know, challenge yourself. Do something you're afraid of. Do something you're absolutely petrified of. Take incremental steps. Learn how to do it and get over your fear. It's incredibly empowering.
I want to thank John Loken for joining me. Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was fun.